Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet, editor, and teacher Jay Leeming. Leeming is author of two collections of poetry, Dynamite on a China Plate and his most recent Miracle Atlas, which was the winner of the 2011 Gel Poetry Prize and was published by Big Pencil Press. His poems have appeared in many journals, including Plowshares, the Gettysburg Review, and Poetry East. He has taught poetry workshops throughout the U.S. and abroad, and was a recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. He is also editor and founder of the journal Rowboat, Poetry in Translation. And welcome to the show, Jay.
Thanks, Tish. It's great to be here.
Yeah, nice to see you again. Now, your second book of poetry, Miracle Atlas, arrived 5 years after your first collection. Is this a different Jay in this collection? Have you changed your style at all?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, are any of us the same after 5 years, right? You know?
Hopefully not.
Well, yeah, I guess, yeah, so it is different. It's all retrospective, right? You know, but looking back now, I see it's a more mature book, of course, I guess. Uh-huh. Oh, that word mature, it's funny.
But, it feels more intimate to me. A lot of the poetry seems more intimate and maybe more thoughtful as we get older. We maybe think more deeply.
Yeah. Well, my father passed away in 2003, so, you know, that'll change a person, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's in this book in a certain way, an awareness of, you know, what's at stake to be alive on this earth.
Yeah, and there is a lot at stake now. Yeah. Now, I was wondering if your approaches or thoughts did change after the first book was published. Was it a validation or was it more pressure to, once you started, you know, being taken seriously, I suppose you would call it?
My approach to writing.
Yeah. Did it change you?
Yeah, let's see. It makes you more self-conscious, you know.
Really?
Which is never, I mean, it did for me, you know, which is never good, really. It's a little good, you know. Yeah, you're more aware. You can sort of plan where you're going to go next poetically. But, yeah, there's a risk of kind of seizing up and like, oh, I'm writing a poem, you know, which has always been something I've kind of tried to avoid. But, I mean, I love to write, you know. So just hanging on to that is not too hard. And that's the way to go, you know. Because if you start thinking, oh, this will be great. I'll read this on Tish Perlman's show, you know, as you're writing it, you know, that can totally paralyze you. You know?
Well, I was thinking the validation of having a first book published might either free you or make you, you know, afraid because the expectations are greater now, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's very freeing in one sense. It's sort of a healing thing because, you know, you write poetry alone generally, you know, and whenever you give it to the world and it's well received, that's a beautiful gift, you know. And growing up in this culture, you know, poetry doesn't earn money, you know, so.
That's right.
Of course not. You don't get rich with poetry. So when you read it to people and they actually like it, it's tremendously gratifying. And you realize the world needs playfulness and imagination, you know, as much as it needs everything else.
Yeah. And I think poetry offers a bit of clarity to people. You know, a lot of people don't know how to express how they're feeling, and poetry is one of those magic mediums, I think.
Right. Eloquence, you know, getting the right word.
Exactly. Know, and then people go, oh, my God, that's what I was thinking.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a lot of poets, when they say I in their poems, they say that they're talking the universal I. How do you approach it? Are you really talking about yourself? Is it more of a confessional style, or is it meant to be universal?
It depends on the poem, but I want to connect with people through the poetry, you know. So I do put myself in there, and I think most of the time I is really I, you know, it's really me. And yeah, it's important to me to connect through the words, you know, and not shut people out.
Yeah. So. Well, I would think the I in just us individually is universal. But I was just reading an interview where one poet said, no way, it's me. It's not confessional, you know, it was almost a defensive reaction.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, poetry is very intimate as a form, you know, because people read it, they can read it aloud or even just silently. And the breath and the way of saying a thing is on the page with the silences and the line breaks you put in. So even though it might be I, you know, Jay Leeming, you know, somebody else can inhabit that I for even a brief time. So that's a beautiful thing.
You know, a lot of people insist that poetry was meant to be a spoken language. Do you feel that way as well? And does it change when it's spoken rather than when it's just read, do you think?
Yeah, I think it changes. I'm not sure I would say meant to be, but I mean, it certainly began that way. It has its roots in the spoken language. And I love it as a spoken thing. You know, thousands of years of past, right? So now we read things. We read silently. You know, people used to read aloud all the time, you know, before the Renaissance. People read something and they would speak it when they read it. So I love the auditory, you know, because I began as a songwriter, you know, I spent years writing songs.
Yeah.
And I love the way the words can live in the air, in the sound, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't want to put a fence around it, you know, and say they only have to be that.
Yeah, yeah. But do you think sometimes things do change meaning? Do you read poems aloud and then change words or any of the lines because of it?
Oh, sure. Oh, definitely. Yeah, because I want it to sound good, you know, and the sound is part of the meaning, you know. A poem is different. It's not just what the words mean, but it's how the sound hits you, you know,
uh-huh.
And that carries a force, you know, which isn't exactly in the dictionary necessarily. So I do read them aloud and frequently change things to make it really, make it sing.
Yeah, no, I understand that totally. Now, I want you to read a piece from Miracle Atlas,
sure.
the new book. This one's called Beggar, and it's the first one in the collection, and it's an amazing piece, I think. Just tell us a little about it before you read it.
Yeah, well, gosh, where did it begin? I don't know where this began. I think it's as like a lot of my poems, it's sort of an idea I just sort of had, and you follow and see where it leads. And much of the time, I didn't know where it would lead, you know? It's like a little trail in the forest or something. And I think, you know, I probably tried numerous different ways of ending the poem before I found a way that felt true, you know?
Uh-huh.
'Cause even though it's an imaginary poem in some ways, you know, there's a truth there. It's like imagination is a way of finding things out. And, you know, you have to feel your way through until you get something which feels right.
Uh-huh.
Well,
I'd love you to read it.
Okay. So this is called Beggar. It was the bardic scientists of the ancient future who discovered that at the heart of everything, there was not a particle, a quark, or a vibrating string, but a single line of poetry, a thread of words that had no end. It began, "Once there was a beggar in a town by the sea, his cloak wet with rain and stained with a memory of a temple of yellow sand." And went on like that, for as long as you cared to listen, unquenchable spring, beam of light from a distant star. They tried an apple, a shoe, a butterfly's wing. It was in all of them, beginning as soon as you paused to hear. And no one could find the end of it, though poets and other explorers traveled far up its length, journeying deep into that wilderness, to bring back phrases like turtle's eye, no one's chocolate, and a shadow, and queen-dazzled taste of the rain. Many thought all of this was ridiculous and a waste of time, that the universe had to be composed of numbers, not this slippery ribbon of language. Others complained and said that such a poem should begin with a king or a great hero or at least a child. But every time that anyone listened, it began with a beggar, a man grunting with the dirt of many villages, his hand reaching out from his own smell to prod you for a cigarette, a crust of bread, or some loose change. No one knew who he was or where he had come from, but it was his wanderings that had made the world.
Love it. Great. Great.
Thanks.
Do you ever write a poem and then go back to it in a day or two to polish it or whatever and say, whoa, where did that come from?
Where did the original thing
come from? Yeah, where did this poem come from? Like it came from your unconscious.
It does happen,
uh-huh.
You know. I mean, there's the whatever you want to call it, the right and left brain or the conscious and the unconscious, you know. There is this sort of dreamlike sense in which you write things down, you know, sometimes in the middle of the night or something like
that, you know.
And then you go back and the other part of your brain tries to put it together, and sometimes it's kind of disappointing, you know. I mean,
uh-huh.
I mean, you write some wild thing, you know, love is a green refrigerator covered in noise, you know, and then you start trying to fix it the next day and end it, for example, and it's like, well, love is a rose, you know, love is a box of chocolate.
So you become too rational and you become trite, right?
Well, that's a tendency I have anyway, you know. So when things are going well, there is that sense of wonder that, like, where did this come from, you know, but not all the time, certainly.
Well, I think poetry in some startling way helps us meet the stranger in ourselves, you know, when you wake up and, I write poetry as well, as people know at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wake up sometimes and go, whoa, who wrote that?
Yeah.
You know?
You mean the part of yourself you don't know?
Yeah, the part of myself that's telling a story that I am either not aware of or haven't really been paying attention to.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I read in an interview that you used a term about one of your poems that it arrived home nicely. Well, what does that mean to you? You have a perfect ending or?
It arrived home nicely. Yeah. I wonder what I was meaning.
I
probably, you know.
Wrapped it up.
Wrapped it up, yeah. I mean, you can feel when the poem is done. I can, usually. Mm-hmm. And also when it's not done, you know, something sort of jangles and it doesn't quite fit, you know. Mm-hmm. So when things are going well, which isn't all the time, you know, you can feel the whole arc of a poem's movement as you write, you know, like, oh, this is the end, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like having a big yard full of cars that some of them start and some of them don't, you know, and some need a new battery and others need a clutch. I mean, that's what writing is like. And then it's not always this big, wonderful thing where they arrive home nicely, as uh-huh. I once said. Uh-huh. Often you're more like just struggling to get the thing to work.
That's know? Right. So, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like a poem has to end on a perfect line? Do you need a good ending? Does the poem get ruined if you don't find a good way to stop?
Well, it's like building a house or cooking a meal, right? You know, you want the dessert to be good too. So, I mean, yes, I wouldn't want to write any laws in the sand, you know, but I'd like it to have a good ending, that's mm-hmm. for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In our last interview, you talked about how poetry is healing. Mm-hmm. Do you still feel that way? Will that always be the thread?
I mean, yeah, I think it's healing, definitely. I mean, lots of things are healing in this life. You know, taking a walk is healing too, you know. But that is one of poetry's functions. You know, it's not its only way of working, but it's been healing for me, you know. It's been a way of finding my way in the world without denying the playful and imaginative parts of myself, you know, finding a way that they fit in. And I think that's something the world does need, you know, that sense of imagination and playfulness. Uh-huh. So that's healing.
Do you feel kind of estranged from the world if you're not writing?
I don't know. It depends on a lot of things. It depends what uh-huh. I'm doing, you know. And like all of us, I've got many different sort of sides of myself, I guess. So, but if I spend a long time not writing, yeah, I would say I feel a little estranged from myself more than from the world, you know, uh-huh. estranged from like who I really am, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, I want you to read another poem from Miracle Atlas. This is a really gorgeous poem. I mean, I wanted to show all these different contrasts of mm-hmm. the different kinds of things that you write. This one's called River, mm-hmm. and it's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, here you go. I mean, Ithaca, you know, where we both live, you know, there's a lot of rivers around, so I guess this subject had to come to me eventually. River. The river leaves this valley over and over. It has been leaving it for thousands of years. A little trickling among the rocks, a leaf swept away, a branch slipped past a few stones. And perhaps I, too, am made only of departure. Keys in my pocket and name written in sand. We stay by going. The river abandons every place that it visits and so remains there.
That's great. When I was reading it, and I read it several times, I was thinking it felt like a poem of one piece. Did you write that in just one sitting and not have to polish much? Or
this was definitely a poem where I had the I had the first half, and then how to end it was the thing. But I was aiming for exactly what you're talking about, however. Uh-huh. It's different from some other poems. It's sort of all, you know, it's like a little bubble, you know, right? So you're right there, you know, all one little song, you know, one little melody. But I did have trouble. You know, I remember getting halfway through and being like, where does this go, you know? I think when I came up with We Stay by Going, that seemed like a door into the end of the poem, uh-huh. And the paradoxical nature of that. So,
it evokes nature, and it sounds like you were in a peaceful place. I really liked it.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was writing this, I was living right near Ithaca Falls, you know, that big, huge, crashing waterfall. So uh-huh. I could go there a lot, and I was thinking of that creek in the falls there.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about Miracle Atlas. Where did this title come from? Does it have to do with the travels that you have been on, or tell us?
Where did that come from? I just dreamed it up one day, and it felt right.
Really?
Poets are so annoying. They just say stuff like that. You know, I'd love to give you a solid answer. Like, I found it in a book. It's a reference to an ancient Greek philosopher. It felt right. I like the sound of it, and it invoked the wide-ranging quality that I think this book hopefully has, and the wondrous quality. Because poetry, for me, is in many ways restoring my own sense of wonder at anything, at a fork, at a mountain. You know. So hopefully this book of poems does include many moments like that of wonder and miraculous things, you know.
Uh-huh. If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Jay Leeming. We're talking about his new book, Miracle Atlas. You were the poet laureate for Tompkins County for 2009-2010. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that experience was like for you. Did it deepen your commitment?
That was a delight, that experience. One of the requirements is that you read poems to the county legislature, which was a pleasure. And again, poetry's right in there with the public comment period and all the stuff they have to deal with, you know, which is quite a lot there. And I took it as a sense of permission. Again, it's the world saying, hey, keep doing what you're doing. And it was that was very nice to have, you know. Also, it's an opportunity to, you know, if you want, take on the task of speaking for a place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up here in Ithaca and returned after about 15 years away. So it made me grateful to be back, and it made me want to value those connections to this place.
Uh-huh. And was one of the requirements to try to turn the community onto poetry or keep poetry alive in the community?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's a nice position. They don't stipulate a lot of requirements, but that is one of them, you know, a willingness to promote poetry in the community. You know?
Uh-huh.
At the time, I was teaching poetry at Lifelong to senior citizens, which I did for 5 years. You know, I visited schools a lot and stuff like that. So.
I met when you last visited us, we talked about that.
Yeah.
What a rich experience that was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want you to read another poem from Miracle Atlas. This one's called Retrospective. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting questioning kind of poem. It resonated for me. Tell us a little about it.
Well, I'd love to hear why you picked it, actually. But, for me, it's maybe this speaks to your question earlier about the self-consciousness or the any change in writing a second book, you know. And this poem speaks to a certain awareness, you know, that comes with time, I guess, of writing poems and realizing that you've learned to do a thing in a certain way, but there are other ways. Uh-huh. You know, a potter makes a round bowl and works years to make a really round bowl, but you could make a square bowl if you wanted, you know. So this is a poem about that, more or less.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I'll just read it. It's called Retrospective. How to say it, that after working for years to wrestle words into something like music, it now feels that those harmonies could coax you from the truth, from the fumes of the bulldozer or the shopping cart rusting in a ditch beside the highway. That now your way of saying things might be an impediment, a block as difficult as stuttering or weakness or an oak tree fallen across a road. That now fluency itself might be a problem, a method of shutting out the parking garage or the idiot rattle of a windblown can or the 10,000 carnival threats of advertising, jingle and squonk, cell phones and loneliness, and a certain slump in the shoulders. How the two of us fumed in silence, layers of argument crackling underfoot like sheets of ice. That all this time I've been using language to protect myself, to select and ignore, to avoid pain, that one day I might look down at my words and notice only how determined I was not to see.
Yeah. You know why that resonated for me? Because I've heard people say that they try so hard to write about the world, they forget to live it.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember that the writer, the French writer Anis Nin, said, "You're always talking about your dreams. When do you dream them?" You know. So
right.
Some, you know, and I remember when I was a kid, I would always want to be writing in my diary when we went on vacation, and I was thinking, "How come you're not swimming? Why do you keep running back to try to, you know, instead of live the experience, you're trying to record it all the time?" That's why that poem resonated.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for me, I think you look back at the work you've done, and poetry is a very inclusive art. You know, you can write about a lot of things. You know, almost anything. You know,
So
then you look back and you see what isn't in there. You know, it's like, why aren't there more cell phones in these poems? You know, why isn't Google.com in here or whatever? You know, so you know, just looking back and seeing what was missing from the poems and wanting to include more. For me, like a lot of us, you know, what I have not included is sort of the darker things. You know. The uglier things or the harder things.
And tell me why you don't include those. I was going to ask you, do you censor yourself?
I try not to, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Especially in the writing, you know. I try to just give free rein to everything, you know. I mean, I think there's plenty of dark things in this book, really.
Yeah, there are. And in the first book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks. But, you know, it's just natural, you know. You don't want to dwell on certain things. And I'm a lover of beauty, I guess, right? As a poet, you know, not all poets are. So I don't always put in, you know, the mattress at the side of the highway that's all soggy with rain. You know?
When we go back to that healing idea as well, right? You know, I mean, it's just not necessarily healing to dwell on the negative and the dark and the
right.
horrible. Well, what about politics, though? It seems to me that there's more politics. There was more politics in your first book.
Ah, yeah. I think you're right about that. Well, politics per se. I mean, there's a poem about a demonstration in that book and stuff. In this book, I mean, it's more internal, you know, the sense of the world is there, you know, but it's not as overt, not as direct, perhaps.
Uh-huh. You know? Yeah, and that's how you've evolved.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when we're younger, we are more idealistic, and I was involved in politics as a younger person and not so much now.
Sure. I mean, and I've come to see the political effect that poems can have, even if they're about socks or baking bread, you know, and sometimes a more direct political effect than it's about, you know, vote for blank.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And it's true. In the first book, you know, I worked for Greenpeace for a year and a half, and there's a couple poems from that time.
Uh-huh.
You know? I think the poems in here have as much a political effect as in the first book, but it's just less directly stated, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I think it's political to just connect people with their own lives. You know, I think people are really disconnected.
Yeah.
As much as we talk about how connected everybody is by all this new technology, I don't think so. There's still a soul that needs something more, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have to talk about why did you start this literary project called Rowboat? Tell us about it.
So, yeah, I founded a magazine called Rowboat about a year ago, and it's a magazine of poetry that's translated into English from other languages. So, basically, it's poems from everywhere except the U.S., you know, basically, and it's been a delight. I started it because I've always been inspired by poetry from other countries, you know,
uh-huh.
Pablo Neruda, for example,
uh-huh.
Cesar Vallejo, you know, from Peru, and poetry for me has always been this sort of wild animal thing from somewhere else, and somehow it can be very miraculous when you read about other countries and what's going on there and how people perceive the world, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to connect myself with those types of things. And so I started this magazine with some friends of mine, and we're going along, chugging along. Our second issue just came out.
Uh-huh.
We have a website, I should say, rowboatmagazine.com. It's great. I mean, we've got, the first issue had a Tibetan-Mongolian story in it that was oral and was only recently written down. We've got poetry from Estonia and Uruguay and China, Germany, Poland. I mean, it's just a lot of fun to put together.
Well, tell us how this happens, though. I mean, do you find poems in Russian and Spanish and have somebody translate, or do people send in their own translations? How does that work?
Well, these days, as you mentioned, you know, the world is very connected in certain ways. You know, there are quite a few translators out there, you know, who are working on things as a labor of love, you know, and then want to find a place to print it, you know. And in some cases, I have sought people out for sure,
mm-hmm.
People I knew that I knew were working on things. And so we have a website and people submit things, you know, and then we look at it and select what we like and put it in the magazine, you know.
Huh. And you're not restricted by subjects, or it doesn't have to be about certain things.
No, I try and make it as wide-ranging as possible, you know. We've mm-hmm. also put at the end of each issue a poem and a really literal translation for our readers to make their own versions, you know. We put a Charles Baudelaire poem in the first issue, and people say it was a contest. People send in their translations, and we pick a winner, and they get a subscription, which was a lot of fun. 'Cause you see all these, like, 20 different versions of the same poem, you know, all.
Well, how do you decide, though? I mean, I've often wondered about translation. It depends mm-hmm. on who's translating.
Yeah.
Whether something, you know, looks like it's going to resonate or something. I don't understand how you tell if it's a good translation of Rilke, for instance.
Right, right. Well, good is a fuzzy, slippery term.
It is, yeah.
In this case, we picked the one all five of us liked the most. You know, we just voted on it, myself and the other editors. But yeah, hopefully you have something which has some of the spirit of the original. You know, it's very possible to be literally true, but then, like, completely wrong as far as the feeling of something.
That's
you
interesting,
know?
Yeah.
Because you might read it and it's like, wow, Rilke must have been a klutzy writer, you know, because it just doesn't make any sense. You know, so hopefully you have something which has some of the fire and the spirit of the original, but is not way off base, you know, not uh-huh. completely out there.
Has your stuff been translated into other languages, or have you translated it?
Years back, I fooled around with it, but actually a friend of mine locally is working on translating this whole book into German, so that's a delight
uh-huh.
to see.
And do you translate? Do you know another language?
Well, I lived in Austria for a year back in college, and so I'm pretty fluent in German.
Wow.
But you know, poetry's hard, you know? It's a different
thing. It is an entirely different language, even from a foreign language, you know? It's foreign on top of foreign in some ways.
Yeah, so my ability to read German poetry is there. But it helps me to have the English as well.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Now, do you still teach Have you been doing any teaching?
Most recently, I really haven't so much. My wife and I just had a daughter 3 weeks ago. So
yeah, congratulations
thank
on that,
you.
Too.
Yeah, so that's a whole new creative project, which changes the whole story, you know. But, you know, in the past year, yeah, I've taught workshops around and about, you know, in Minnesota and places like that. Uh-huh. So, and I hope to do more of that in the future. I like traveling to teach poetry workshops.
Uh-huh. And what are some of the things you tell aspiring poets? Is there a rule of thumb?
A lot of what you can teach is just the habit of valuing your own ideas, your own thoughts, you know, and of letting things in the door, you know. Poetry can be sort of exclusive sometimes, if like you're learning in a class, for example, you know, mm-hmm. if things come with big frames around them, you know, and like, ooh, wow, this is important, you know. But, you know, I just allow people to let it out, you know, just scribble a whole bunch of stuff down, and that habit of freeing your own voice is very useful. It's useful to me now, and I think it's useful to beginners as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I just try to make them feel comfortable, and let's give it a shot.
Yeah, yeah. And people have to learn to not be afraid to fail, too.
Absolutely.
You know, that's for anybody in the arts, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Almost everybody I've ever had on says that's one of the, you know, the key things that somebody needs to learn.
Yeah, a music teacher of mine once said something like, you have to write, you know, a lot of bad music before you write any good music. And so each bad poem you write is just another step, you know? It's like, oh, someday I'll get through with all my bad poems and I'll write only... I mean, it isn't quite like that, but...
Yeah. How can you tell when you've written a bad poem, though? Now that you've been writing for so many years, well, do you have a criterion in your head? Is it the music, or...?
Well, it's just if I like it or not, you know? I mean... And we've all got our own methods, our own versions of badness. For me, I, you know, sometimes I can write things very flighty and just dancing all around with a million images, you know, purple flamingos and Elvis and stuff, but it never, maybe it doesn't say anything, you know.
Ah.
So for me, in my particular case, I really want something that says something to the heart as well and isn't just a big fantastical escape, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have time, so I want to have you read one more piece from Miracle Atlas. This is called Around the Fire.
Mm-hmm. Around the Fire. One night I found myself at the blazing fire of big questions, a fire burning in a rusty oil drum at the edge of town. A few others were there too, warming their hands over the flames. Why am I here? Was burning well. Is there an afterlife? Was going strong. Around us were fields of brown stubble and leftover snow, some distant buildings flickering with shadow. Now and then someone threw another question in there, and we watched as it crackled and began to burn. No one said anything. Nothing was discussed or debated. It was enough simply to stand there, warmed by the fire's heat, as one spark after another flung itself up into the dark and went out.
Lovely. I really like that one, too. I can see you standing in front of a fire and, you know, how magic those moments are.
Thanks, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we are almost out of time. Do you want to give some contact information in case people want to get in touch?
Sure.
And buy the book?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a website, jayleeming.com, so JAYLEEMING, not the small rodent that jumps off cliffs, but Leeming. So yeah, there's some poems on there and some sound files of me reading poetry, as well as you can buy the new book there as well.
Uh-huh. And the book's available at the local stores too, right? Buffalo Street.
Yeah, here in Ithaca.
Green Star.
Green Star as well, and Buffalo Street Books here locally.
Yeah.
And rowboatmagazine.com if you want to find out about that magazine and subscribe there as well.
Well, that's great. Jay Leeming, thank you so much for joining us. Keep on writing. We just love your work. It's just great.
Thank you so much, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.